I'm Kristen Hetzel, vacation planner, world traveler, Disney foodie, and theme park fan.
I'm Al John Go. I'm the husband who's also Disney, Star Wars, and Marvel Comics fan. And together, we host a Disney List podcast.
Every week, you'll hear us list our favorite things about Disney theme parks, films, shows, travel, Marvel, and Star Wars in a top 10 list, rankings, and more.
That's an impressive list. Subscribe to the Disney List podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, or your favorite podcast platform. You can even stream us on Sorcerer Radio at srsounds.com and check out our live shows on Facebook. The Disney List podcast. Visit thedisneylist.com.
Podcast, talking all things Disney with your hosts, Al John Go and Dave Bossert.
What a great show today, folks. We got Black Cauldron producer Joe Hale. We're going to be talking about Sean Connery. Rest in peace. I'm Al John Go. I am a huge Marvel, Disney, and Star Wars fan, big fan of pop culture. And every week on this show, we talk about all things Disney with my co-host with the most, Mr. Dave. Dave.
Al John, how are you?
Good.
This is Dave Bossert. I'm an artist, filmmaker, author, and welcome to the Skull Rock Podcast. If you love Disney and pop culture, please subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast platform, as well as like us and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can email us questions, and we do read all the questions that come in, and we try and get them on air, but you can email us at aljohn@skullrockpodcast.com or to me at dave@skullrockpodcast.com. And wow, we've got one heck of a show ahead of us, don't we, Al John?
We have an awesome show for you. As I teased earlier, we're going to talk to Joe Hale, who's a friend of yours, obviously a great producer and artist. And we're going to talk to him about the Black Cauldron. I mean, the Black Cauldron celebrating a huge anniversary.
Hey, 35th anniversary. I mean, it's hard to believe, isn't it?
I know. I just saw the film the other week, watching it with my wife, Kristen. And once again, it holds up. And I just love everything about the art style. I like the fact that it's edgy. And we're going to talk a little bit about that.
I'm going to ask you, Al John,
okay.
when you look at the Black Cauldron, does the Black Cauldron feel more of that? I guess really what I'm looking at is, does the styling feel like vintage Disney animated feature film compared to the pictures that came after it? For me, it does, by the way, and I'll just throw that out. But I'm just curious what your thoughts are.
You know, a little bit of both. It's interesting because the lines, I think, are different. Mm-hmm. To a certain degree. There was a time, Dave, and where, like 101 Dalmatians, for example, it had a little bit of a, I don't know, you're the artist, so please correct me, but it was a different, just a slightly different look. And, you know, Oliver and Company had a slightly different look, but
textures. Like every Disney animated film has a style to it,
right,
that they cue off of. But for me, I've always looked at the Black Cauldron. It's almost like it's the tail end of that generation, the nine old men, the guys that did those early pictures, Pinocchio and Snow White,
yes,
Bambi and Lady and the Tramp and stuff like that. And I always get that feeling, and I just rewatched the movie last week in prep for our show, and you know, the backgrounds are stunning, I think, in, yeah, the Black Cauldron, and there's some really terrific animation. I mean, look, we're going to get into all of that with Joe, but a couple of bits to talk about. I mean, the passing of Sean Connery. Yep. Wow.
Yep. We'll definitely get into that. And but yes, before we do that, let's send a shout out to our incredible supporters. You know, we do this podcast free every single week for you. It's our pleasure to share our fandom with you, but we'd like to give our shout outs to our big supporters. We have Lindsay and Charles. Once again, thank you so much for supporting our show. You're part of the family. And if you're interested, feel free to visit us at anchor.fm/Skull Rock Podcast and show your support. It's all good. And now I guess it's time to talk about
Skull Rock Podcast, ripped from the headlines. It's Skull Rock Podcast headline news.
Oh my gosh, Dave, can 2020 take any more from us? I mean, it's just one of these, you know, one of these several weeks we've had so many titans of entertainment pass away.
We have, and you know something I have to say, Sean Connery, great actor, Academy Award winning actor. He had such a presence on screen. But you know what? He was 90 years old. What a life.
Oh, man.
What a life. I mean, he was the original James Bond.
I need Count another 1,000.
I admire your courage, Miss
Trench. Sylvia Trench. I admire your luck, Mr.
Bond. James Bond.
Mr. Bond, I suppose you wouldn't care to raise the limit?
I have no objection.
And, you know, I could talk about James Bond all day long because I've seen every one of the movies.
Right.
And I'm chomping at the bit to see the latest one. And we had a scare last week because they literally were talking about possibly putting No Time to Die, the latest James Bond movie with Daniel Craig. They were talking about putting that onto one of the streaming platforms. And I'm like, no, you can't do that. There's no way. And obviously the economics didn't make sense for them to do it because they're just going to put it out hopefully in April. It was supposed to go out last April. It got moved to November. And now because of the pandemic that we're all in the midst of, it's been moved again to next April, April 21, to see it. But boy, Sean Connery was the man. He started it all with those three simple words, right?
Exactly, right.
I Bond, mean, James Bond.
Shaken, not stirred.
There you go. Another three words there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's so quotable. I mean, and the Scottish accent, you know, Mish Money Penny, right?
Yes,
I mean, just everything about it. I named my dog. You know. I mean, there's just so many things you could say about Sean Connery.
And what did you find, Junior?
Junior? Dad?
Jeez, what does it always mean? Is this Junior?
That's his name. Henry Jones Junior.
Like Indiana.
We named the dog Indiana.
May we go home now, please?
I have a special place in my heart because my father really, really loved James Bond. And we would go to the library and check out James Bond movies on 8mm. And he'd run it through the projector. And that's how we watched Bambi. That's how we watched Pinocchio. That's how we watched James Bond. This is before the VHS generation happened. But
yeah.
I just can't imagine life without 007 and the prototype, the spy, the secret agent, 007, Sean Connery. And if it wasn't for his portrayal of the legendary James Bond, you would have no Taken. You would have no
Born Identity. Movies, any of those films.
You know, John Wick, a lot of those. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, the Bond franchise really sort of set the tone for it, didn't it?
It really did. Do you have a favorite Bond film of his?
You know, I have to tell you, I really like the Daniel Craig Bond movies. I've been a big fan of Daniel Craig as James Bond. And, you know, look, it's like, do I have a favorite animated picture? Sure, I do. But, you know, at the end of the day, I love them all. And I love all the James Bond movies.
But do you have one film of his that you like so much? Because I can say Dr. No very easily. The other one would be
Goldfinger.
Okay.
Right. I mean, to me, that one stands out a little bit. I don't know. I think Dr. No is an excellent Bond picture.
So,
the one thing about Sean Connery, he didn't win his Academy Award for any of the Bond portrayals.
No.
He won it for The Untouchables.
Yeah, which is also very good. I mean, my tribute to him was the original, the Untouchable, the Professor, Sir Sean Connery. And that's, I mean, Untouchables was amazing. And I would also say that if I was to choose one of my favorite James Bond movies of his, I have to go back to The Backpack, because Thunderball was one of my favorites. And when James put on that backpack, that jetpack, and started blasting off, I was like, man, this is so cool. I've got to make one. And I remember vividly as a child going and getting some cardboard. And I used to do this all the time. I'd take cardboard and cut it up and then craft stuff with it, whether it was, you know, an office space or a desk or just funny things. And then I made a jetpack out of some cardboard boxes. And I was like, this is cool. I'm going to be like James.
Every one of us has done things like that growing up and watching these movies. For me, I just have to say, I just am enthralled every time I watch a Bond movie.
I know it's so great.
And I can watch them over and over again. That's the beauty of those films, you know. Right.
And I think too, you know, circling back to Disney, the fact that he played Indiana Jones's father was great. The chemistry, I thought, between Harrison Ford and him in The Last Crusade for Indiana Jones was just absolutely great. And I thought they paired well together.
Absolutely. And Sir Sean Connery, we will have all the memories and all of the films to enjoy in perpetuity. May he rest in peace.
Dave, you sent me that link about Netflix.
Yeah, you know something? It made me think, again, the news was that Netflix is going to raise their prices. I think they're raising it $1 or $2 per month for the it's $1, I think, increase for the basic service. But this is going to be the beginning of it. I think that you're going to see across the board all the streaming services from time to time are going to start raising their prices. You look at Disney Plus, without question, I think you're going to see a price increase coming sooner rather than later, because they originally projected that they were going to have 60 million subscribers in the first 5 years. And they got 60 million. They blew past that, by the way, in the first 8 months of the service. So kudos to them, you know, for that. But you can definitely see, I think they're going to raise their prices just like they do at the park. You know, the periodic price increases. And in fact, I wouldn't be surprised if you see an increase in park prices next year or whenever this pandemic is really completely over and everybody who has been self-isolating and cooped up in their homes wants to get the heck out of there. I'll tell you right now, the parks will have record attendance. That's what's going to start happening once we get through this pandemic, because people want to get out of their homes.
Oh, this is true.
And by the way, when that happens, I think you're going to see viewership drop off, and you may see attrition in subscribership to all of these different streaming platforms. That may happen.
Well, you heard it here, folks. Dave is he's omniscient. He knows things. You know, maybe he's prescient. I don't know how you want to position it, but mark his words, day and date. I'm thinking too, with this increase, you know, once again, people want great content. They don't mind paying $1 a little extra, because we do the same thing with Hulu and Disney Plus. We added Stars for like $1. And right. It's like, well, great, you know, no problem. We'll add on Stars. But then again, as I said in previous podcasts, I stopped CBS, CBS All Access, and I stopped, I actually stopped Netflix until we have one of our shows come back on. And I don't watch AMC until The Walking Dead. Now The Walking Dead's back, so we may subscribe again. But we want to binge watch everything. And that's just kind of our habit.
I gotta tell you, I totally hear you on that, but I have a bone to pick because The Mandalorian dropped on Friday, October 30th. I watched the first episode, didn't look to see if there were other episodes, but I decided, oh, it's Saturday afternoon, I'm gonna watch the second episode, because I thought, well, didn't they put up all 10 episodes of the of season two like other streamers do so that we can binge watch this? And then I find out, to my surprise, I might add, that I have to wait a week for the next episode.
Okay.
That's outrageous. That's an affront to binge watching.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, they did this last season with The Mandalorian, and I just laughed. I said, this is how they get people past that 1 week trial window. You get them hooked. You can't watch everything all at the same time. You have to watch The Mandalorian because you have to have water cooler, quote unquote, water cooler talk. And everybody's asking me, Aljon, have you seen The Mandalorian season opener yet? And I said, my wife and I haven't yet. Breaking news here, folks. We just got in 2 foster kids. My wife and I have been waiting for kids. And now we got these foster to adopt children and we love them to death.
Congratulations.
Oh, thank you, Dave. But that leaves me with no Mandalorian. It's like, you know, day and night bottle feeding. We're doing all kinds of stuff and I haven't slept right, but we have to wait to do Mandalorian when the kids are put to sleep. And so hopefully that night will be tonight. But having said that, we'll see.
Look, I watched the first episode. I love it. I'm hooked. And now I'm going to not watch it for several weeks so that the episodes pile up so that when I do sit down, I can watch maybe 2 or 3 episodes in a row. That's my strategy now.
That's your strategy.
I think we're done with the news because we're going to go on to a really, I think, an incredible guest, 95 years old, still has it all together. And it's Joe Hale, the producer of The Black Cauldron. We're going to start talking to him shortly. Anything else before we go into that, Aljon?
No, I think we're ready for our interview of the week. I'm Aljon Goh, co-host of the Disney List podcast, as heard on Sorcerer Radio, as well as Skull Rock podcast, here with my wife, Kristen. Hello.
Hello.
You are an earmarked agent who books Disney travel vacations for people all the time. Give our listeners a reason why they want to give you a call instead of just booking a trip by themselves.
Well, I can do all of the legwork for them. I have expertise. I've been to the Disney parks well over 100 times, so they've got that knowledge at their hand, as well as it saves them time and money.
Where can people get in touch with you so that they can book their next Disney cruise, Disney park trip, Adventures by Disney?
They can contact me at themeparksandcruises@gmail.com.
Skull Rock Podcast, interview time.
We are so honored and welcomed. We are just so honored to have here not only one of the most amazing animators and visual effects people around. He's been nominated for an Academy Award for The Black Hole, one of my favorite films. Also, an animation for Robin Hood, Sleeping Beauty, and of course, the producer of The Black Cauldron that also Dave worked on. Please welcome Joe Hale. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Glad to be here.
Oh, yes.
Hi, Joe. It's Dave. How you doing?
Just doing fine.
So Joe, to start out with, I wanted to kind of put in context for our listeners. This past June, you turned 95 years old.
Yes.
Awesome.
It's unbelievable. You were born in June of 1925, and you were born in Michigan, but you grew up in Indiana.
No, it's just the opposite. I was born in Indiana.
Oh, I grew up in Michigan.
Yeah, I was born in a little town. It wasn't even a town. I looked it up. I Googled it. It's a parking lot. literally. It was a little village. It was a series of little white one room shacks along an onion field.
Wow.
And my dad, this was, you know, during the Depression, he was wheel hoeing onions. And my mother knew when I was due, so she made sure he was out of the house. And my mother delivered me by herself.
Wow.
And then she waved a blanket or something, and it got my father's attention. And he came in, and she sent him, she said, go get your mother. And he went and got his mother, and she came over and helped her clean everything up.
Wow. That's something but else.
I lived there till we were, till I was four. And then we moved to Michigan, Chelsea, Michigan, a little town about 15 miles, I think, near Ann Arbor. I think it was east of Ann Arbor. No, west of Ann Arbor.
And I understand that you saw Bambi 7 times in 3 days when it was released.
Yeah, you know, yeah. To me, that's still my favorite Disney movie of all time. We looked at it just the other day. I hadn't seen it. I purposely stayed away from it for several years because I wanted to see if it still had that impact. And it sure did. It was to me, it's still Disney's perfect film.
It's one of those movies that has resonated from generation to generation.
Yes. And I'm going to see it with my two grandnieces.
Great-granddaughters, honey.
Great-granddaughters in a few weeks when things kind of get back to normal.
Oh, good.
I want to see it with them.
With fresh eyes.
I can remember sitting during interviews. I remember this one interview with, I think, Tom Leach was. I don't remember who the guy was, but some newspaper man or something. And they were interviewing my office, and we were talking about art. And I said, well, I got you talking about Bambi. And I said, if I had to make a choice between saving Bambi, the negative of Bambi, and the Mona Lisa, I know which one I'd take. And awesome. I remember seeing the guy from publicity going, oh, kind of wincing. But I believe that, and I would.
Well, the Disney animated films are works of art.
And
every bit as relevant as a painting. That was when you decided you set your sights on wanting to become a Disney animator.
Well, you know, I never thought that could possibly ever happen. You know what I mean? I didn't think I had anywhere near near the talent to do a Bambi. Or I didn't really even understand animation, and I didn't know the names of any of the animators. I didn't. And so when I started working at Disney, Ollie Johnson and all these names of people who had worked on Bambi were like gods to me.
Yeah. But before we get to you working at Disney, you dropped out of high school in 1943 and you signed up with the Marine Corps because of World War II.
Awesome.
Yes, they were, and they had announced that everybody, when you turned 18, you had to sign up and register for the draft. But you know, and you didn't, and you could tell them you wanted the Navy or Marine Corps or Air Force or whatever, Air Corps, and but you didn't know if you were going to get it or not. So I wanted to make sure I didn't for some reason or other, I didn't want to go in the Army. So I. Talked to two of my friends. We talked about it on a Sunday, and the next day we drove down to Detroit in his dad's car. And the first place we came to was Marine Corps. We looked in, and here's these Marines in their dress blues, and you know. So we said, let's try this. I said that. let's try this. And we went in and. They had to sign, you know, fill out some stuff, sign some papers, and they had to strip down, and they gave you a towel to wrap around you. And they had a doctor there that gave you a quick physical. And I remember, what is this little thing going around there?
I don't know. I can't get rid of it.
That's all right. We're getting you on this.
Okay. You're not seeing anything?
Yeah. Okay. So, I weighed 119 pounds and I was 5'8". So I was really skinny. And I was going through the physical thing and the doctor said, okay, bend over and spread your cheeks. So I went.
But for the audience, Joe pulled the corners of his mouth and he bent over with his mouth open.
Anyway, so I passed the physical and I took it to the sergeant, tough looking old guy. And he looks at that and he looks at me and I'm standing there with a towel wrapped around me. And he says, well, you're not exactly what we're looking for, but the doctor couldn't find anything wrong with you. So I guess you're in. And that's how I got in the Marine Corps.
And did your buddies get in as well?
Yes. My one got in, Dan Ewald. He was accepted. He was 18. And another friend of mine, Kenny Slocum, didn't pass. He had a slight heart murmur. So he was so mad. The next day he went down and joined the Navy, and they took him the next day. He was gone within a few days, and we hang around, didn't get called up for a couple of months.
Wow. And so you went into the Marines and you saw action on Iwo Jima in the Pacific. And for the audience, Iwo Jima is a volcanic island north of Guam. It's about halfway between Guam and Tokyo. It's just this little spit of volcanic rock out in the middle of the Pacific, right?
Yeah, I think it was 5 miles long.
It was like 8 square miles.
Yeah. And one end was the volcano where the famous flag raising took place.
A very famous photo. I know you've signed many a photo of that iconic image. I think some of our listeners may not know Iwo Jima, but they do know that iconic picture.
Yes, the famous flag, the most famous picture of World War II.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
And it was funny, we had been dug in on the beach because we couldn't go inland because of the heavy fire for the first 3 days. And we moved up to the next to the first airport, and I was digging in. We had to fill sandbags and dig these 105 artillery howitzers, big one-ton guns in. And I was digging away in. This friend of mine says, hey, Hale, he said, look up on the mountain. There's some guys up there raising a flag, looks like. And I said, oh, great. That sounds, I thought, gee, that's good because we've taken it. And then I never looked up. I just kept digging. And so I missed the famous flag raising, which took place.
Joe, what group were you attending? What division were you in?
I was in the 5th Marine Division.
You're the 5th Marine Division of the Amphibious Corps.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And so you were on Iwo Jima. You saw action there. And then you got discharged in 1946.
Well, I was.
Was it
46?
Yeah, I guess it was.
Yeah, I guess it was. I was after Iwo. We lost so many men and so much equipment. We were supposed to go to Guam and train there, but they sent us all the way back to the Big Island of Hawaii, and we retrained and re-equipped, and we were down at Hilo, and we were loading our ships, and we were on our way to invade Japan, which would have been a real disaster. And they dropped the bombs, atom bombs. So instead of going in as invasion troops, we went to Japan into Nagasaki. And I was in Nagasaki for, I think, about 4 months.
Wow.
We went right where we saw where the bomb had gone off, and the whole city was just flattened. And there was a lot of Catholics, Japanese Catholics. And there was a huge Catholic church, beautiful, had been a beautiful place, and then it had just blown to pieces. You could still see it, it was a church. But a few miles from that was a district where they had the geisha houses. And when the bomb went off, it destroyed the church, but there was a little, some hills between the blast and the bomb went off. So the bomb went over and destroyed everything except the geisha houses. So all the prostitutes were saved and all the priests were destroyed.
Wow.
And they're saying, you know, God does work in mysterious ways.
Yeah, wow. He certainly does. Holy mackerel. What? And so after you get out of the Marines, you got your high school diploma, from what I understand.
Yeah, I took the, Dan and Ken and I were all, they had gotten out just a little before I got out. And there was a teacher, Mabel Fox. She was one of our teachers. And she said, I saw her on the street after I'd been home a few weeks. And she said, Joe, next Tuesday, I want you and Dan and Ken Slocum to meet me in my room in the high school building at 5:00. I want you to make sure you're there. You're going to take your GED test. You got to have a high school diploma. So we went and sat down and she passed out these tests. And she said, now I got something to do for about an hour. So between the three of you guys, you ought to be able to figure this out. So we did, and we all passed with flying colors. So that's how I got my diploma.
And then you went on to art school in Michigan, right?
Yes, we went to Saginaw, Michigan, and for 6 months, for one semester, actually. But he was more of a landscape painter, and I wasn't really interested in that as much as, didn't really know what I was interested in, but I knew I didn't want to do that. And, I'd spent 3 years in the Pacific in the beautiful tropical weather. And that December, we had a big blizzard. It was just before New Year's. It started the end of December and the first couple of days of January. Nothing moved in the town. And I thought, my God, I can't take this cold. So I packed up and got out on the highway and I started hitchhiking towards Chicago. And a truck driver pulled over and those days you could hitchhike. It was safe. And he said, where are you going, son? I said, I'm going to California. I'm going to work for Disney. And where it came from, I don't know. It just popped out of my mouth. So I hitchhiked to California, and I went to Chouinard's and Art Center, and they were both booked up. And so I heard about Lucas Academy of Fine Arts. So I went there and showed Theodore Lucas some of my stuff, things I had done. And he said, we'll take you. So I went there for 2.5 years.
And just for the audience, Theodore, you pronounce it Lucas or Lucas?
Lucas.
Lucas. Yeah, Theodore Lucas was a very well-established portrait painter and landscape artist out here in Los Angeles. He was a plein air painter, and he started this academy, which actually didn't close until, I think, 1990. And how was it going? How was it going to school there?
It was very interesting because a lot of the fellows that went there worked for Pacific Outdoor Advertising, in those days they had billboards all over town, all over the country, really. And he trained all the people for Pacific Outdoor Advertising. And then, and he did all of the, whenever a studio did a picture about, Gauguin or whoever, some famous classic artist, and they needed a portrait of this artist on screen, did of like Olivia de Havilland or whoever. He could paint in any style. He was a fabulous artist.
And so he was able to create paintings for the movies.
Yeah, and so you start off with Lucas. You started off with drawing skeletons. You started from the very basic bones in the body, and you had to learn all the muscles and the names of everything. And it was quite a. And then you started working from nude models and went on from there.
Were there any other Disney artists that went through that academy?
I think that seemed like there was one, but I don't remember who it was now.
Yeah, because most of them went to Chouinard, right?
Yeah, most of them went to Chouinard, yeah.
Which is now Cal Arts.
Yeah. So anyway, after I finished at Lucas, I was working, even though I lived in the valley, not too far from Disney Studios, I thought, well, they'll never hire me there. So I got a job at a silkscreen shop in Culver City, and we did posters and wallpaper and all a whole bunch of stuff. And I worked there for about a year. And then one day my car something was wrong with my car. It was an old used car. And I lived about 5 miles from Disney. So I thought, what the hell, I'm going to go. I just grabbed my portfolio and went over to Disney. And I walked into the office and into the guard shack out in front and talked to a really nice guy, a great guy. He was kind of the head of the security there. His name is O'Reilly. And I said, is there anyone I can talk to about getting a job here? And he said, well, do you belong to the Screen Actors, the Screen Cartoonists Guild? And I said, no. And he said, well, you got to belong to the Screen Cartoonists Guild because this is a union shop. They won't hire you unless you belong to the Screen Cartoonists Guild. So I said, well, I kind of started to pack up and leave. I said, well, I'm going to go over. I'll join the Screen Cartoonists Guild. He said, well, no, you can't join the Screen Cartoonists Guild if you don't have a job at the studio.
That's the famous catch 22 about it, right?
Yeah. That's true. It's very true. They wouldn't hire you.
I was in the same boat many years later because you couldn't get a job unless you were in the Screen Cartoonist Guild, but you couldn't get in the Screen Cartoonist Guild unless you had a job. So it was really about having a studio say, we want to hire this guy. Then they put you into the Screen Cartoonist
Guild. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, he said, well, here, let me make a phone call. He called Andy Ingman. And he said, I heard him say on the phone, he said, I got this young fellow out here he wants to show somebody his artwork. And Andy didn't have anything to do at that particular time. So he said, well, send him on in. So I thought, great, I'll get to get inside the studio and see what it's really like and maybe see some real artists. So I went into Andy's office and had my portfolio, which is right over there in the corner. And I never showed you that. I'll show you sometime. Anyway, he looked through it and he said, yeah, we're starting Peter Pan. And he saw I could do, you know, human type figures, which, you know, Peter Pan was a real boy. And he says, yeah, I think we could use you. And I said, really? And he said, yeah. He says, and he told me about Peter Pan. And so I thought, my God. And they gave me sent me down at a desk, and Johnny, forget his name, came in and showed me how to do in-betweens, flipping the paper and drawing the...
Was it John Lounsbury or...?
No.
Johnny Bond.
So he gave me a drawing test, and I passed that okay. So the rest is history.
And so your first picture was Peter Pan?
First picture was, we worked a little bit on Alice in Wonderland.
Finishing it off, yeah.
Yeah. And then we, you know, in those days you would do, between features, they always had a bunch of shorts, you know, Mickey cartoons. And the 6 minute short subjects with Donald Duck, Goofy, or those things. So you did, we did, a, I don't know, 10 or 12 of those between each feature at that time.
Yeah.
So that's how I, you know, so I started off doing, really doing Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck.
And then you went into layout, is that right?
No, I stayed in animation, and I, Kimball, Ward Kimball, was doing some of these,
It's Tough to Be a Bird, and
yeah, those things.
Toot Whistle Plunk, or Whistle yeah. Toot Plunk, yeah.
And so I worked for Ward, and he liked the way I drew, so I worked with Ward. We became good friends, and then one day I thought, I was working away, and I thought, this really isn't Disney, this the Kimball type stuff. I wanted to do the feature type. And so I went to, I was talking to Don Griffith about it, and he said, well, listen, why don't you go into layout? He said, you can, you know, he said, oh, he can work with me. So I went and talked to Ken Peterson, and I said, you know, Ken, I've been working on the Kimball type stuff, and that's not really Disney feature, and that's not going to last forever. I think it's kind of a fad right now. And I said, you know, we've got the Nine Old Men, and then we, that are great, great, great animators. And then we got another, next to the Nine Old Men, we got about 12 or 15, what they call shorts animators, which were as good as, really damn near as good as the Nine Old Men. And then we had the top, really professional assistant animators that worked for the nine old men and the other nine old men. So it looked, I thought, geez, I'll be doing cleanup here for the rest of my life. So I said, I'd like to try layout. And I told them about talking to Don. And so they said, yeah. So then that's how I went into layout on, I think it was Sleeping Beauty. Yeah, it was Sleeping Beauty. That was my first layout. And
And that was a very stylized picture, too, because
yes.
you were mentioning with Ward Kimball, during that time period in the 50s, you had the UPA-style cartoons, which were very, yeah. Very, very, very graphic cartoons, like Mr. Magoo and things like that. And it was Ward gravitated to those new styles. Yeah. But it was a departure from the sort of classic Disney animation.
Yes. Yeah.
And so you did lay out on Sleeping Beauty.
Yeah, I used to walk around the lot, and I always wanted to see what was going on in different departments. So I was walking on the third floor one day on my lunch hour, and I looked in the room, and there's a fellow in there that was doing these really interesting paintings on, I think, Lady and the Tramp, some backgrounds. And I walked in, we got talking, and it turned out it was new. It's Ivan Earle. And I was looking at some of the things he was doing, and I said, you know, you're going to make a lot of people envious when they see your work. And anyway, we became real good friends. And when he was doing, when they put him on Sleeping Beauty, he was doing the forest where the princess meets the prince for the first time, where she's dancing with the little animals and singing and all that.
Uh-huh.
And it was being laid out by Colin Campbell, but it wasn't in the Ivan Earle style. Well, Ivan's style was easy to me. It was easy to do. And so I was doing some also, and he said, I want Hale to do sequence 8 for me. I want him to do everything. And so he called me in and told me what he wanted me to do. And I said, great. And so I took all of Colin Campbell, which were beautiful layouts. And I didn't even think about keeping them. I threw them all in the trash. Anyway, that was my first picture was Sleeping Beauty was the
first one that you were fully in layout.
Yeah, well, I did all the layouts in that particular sequence. And yeah. I worked with Don. I worked in a room with Don Griffith. Uh-huh. And we became real good friends.
And did you go right on to 101 Dalmatians from there?
Yeah.
Yeah. And when did you start working on the Wonderful World of Disney material? Or was that sort of happening in between while you guys were working on the features?
Well, I was working with Wilford. After Sleeping Beauty, I went to work with Wilford Jackson mm-hmm. and Dick Humor. And we were doing a TV show. We did a couple of TV shows. And then Wilford Jackson had a heart attack and he retired. And so they started working for Ham Lusk. I worked for Ham on a lot of
Wonderful World of Color.
Yeah, Wonderful World of Color. For about 10 years, I worked on a TV
Little
show.
Ranger and...
Yeah, Little Ranger, Guide to Nature.
Joe, did you have much in the way of interaction at all with Walt Disney? Did you meet him, talk with him?
Well, I was in a lot of story meetings. Well, it was a story meeting with Wilford Jackson and Dick Humor, putting together some shorts and making a Wonderful World of Color TV show out of it. And they got to a point where Walt didn't like what he saw. And so without really thinking, So why don't we do so-and-so? And so I came up with my idea, and Walt said, yeah, I think that'll work. And then he got up and left. And the next day, Les Clark came down, and I was working away, and Les says, hey, listen, Joe, I want to tell you something, and I don't take it the wrong way, because I'm this is for your best interest. When you're in a meeting with Walt and you have an idea, save it till after he's gone, and then tell the director about it. Because if you had come up with a really dumb idea, Walt would have just ripped you to pieces. And he said, I'm telling you this for your own good. And I knew he was.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I was in a lot of meetings with Walt, and but I always sat at one side and I'd take notes or whatever. And I think once he said, "Hey, you're." Being awful quiet, and I said, "Well,
That's awesome. I love those teachable moments that you had there, because you know that's a great lesson in life. Actually, it's a great life lesson.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's always nice to have somebody give you a heads up on things like that too.
Yes,
exactly.
Well, yeah, and I knew that Les Clark was telling me this for my own. Good. There was nothing devious about it. He was just saying, hey, Hale,
that's
if you
awesome.
Want to stay here, you better learn to keep your mouth shut.
Love it.
So, Joe, I think, you know, you spent a lot of time in the animation department. Did you ever get involved with any of the Disneyland projects in the 60s? Did you ever? I know some of the artists would get pulled on to things for a few weeks. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, the reason Sleeping Beauty took so long to make was that Walt was really getting into Disneyland, the design. It was getting ready to open. And so people were doing all sorts of odd jobs. We had to design trash cans and shoulder patches and all that. And Ken Anderson was in the right across the hall from me at that time. And there was I don't know if you remember, there was a little not much bigger than a big swimming pool. It was a circle, and there was a pirate ship, 5/8 scale pirate ship floating in the middle of a beautiful.
Yeah, down at Disneyland. It was off to the side of the castle where Fantasyland is.
Yeah.
And that pirate ship was a little restaurant. Originally, it was called Chicken of the Sea.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it was sponsored by Chicken of the Sea Tuna.
Yeah.
And Ken Anderson was doing a lot of design for the park, and they needed it in a hurry. So he came over and he said, hey, Joe, I got a project for you. And he said, I need to have benches and a eating area and, you know, a little area for the for people to sit and rest and eat, and, you know, or, and because we need something around the pirate ship. So I did some benches kind of based on coral reefs. And there was a skull. I put the skull rock in there. And then later that was all taken out. I think the skull rock is still there, but it was there for a number of years. But
that's, yeah, they ripped all that out during the big Fantasyland makeover.
Yeah, actually, the pirate ship was getting starting to rot away, and I guess they had to. It's too bad. It was a beautiful ship.
Yeah, a portion of that ship is actually in the Peter Pan Flight's ride now.
Oh, really?
When they did a refresh of the Peter Pan's flight, they actually during that whole refurbishing of Fantasyland that they did, took part of that pirate ship and used it in Peter Pan's flight.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah,
that's cool.
So that brings us along, and I think I'm so anxious to talk about the Black Cauldron because this year is the 35th anniversary. Joe Hale was the producer of that movie. He was at the top of the hill on that movie, and Joe, I know you've been talking a lot about it in recent months with interviews and stuff like that. But can you tell our audience when you first got involved with it? Because it was quite a bit before the movie actually ever materialized.
Yeah, I was working on, I had been working on live action films like Peach Dragon and
Bedknobs
and Broomsticks and
The Black Hole.
The Black Hole, yeah. I had been working on live action for about 10 years. And the last one I worked on was Watcher in the Woods, and we finished that. And so I needed a new assignment, so they put me on the
story.
Development.
The Black Hole.
The Cauldron.
Yeah.
Oh, I had a room room by myself, and I really enjoyed it because I'd been 10 years with live action, which is really a lot of fun, but it's a lot of hassle too. So anyway, I would sit in there and kind of imagine the boy climbing into the castle. And so I was working on that sequence and really enjoying it. And there had been a lot of problems between the new animators and the old animators. And I didn't want to get involved in that at all. And so I was working by myself, really.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit? Can you talk about it's sort of that new wave of animators that were coming in from CalArts, and the nine old men and some of the people that had been there for decades were starting to get towards retirement, right?
Yeah. And I think...
was there friction between the two groups, or did they
I think Don Bluth and his group had left. By that time.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of just problems.
A lot of chaos, I think, right?
Yeah,
people didn't know what to do, and there were some experienced people had left that were trying to bring those new guys in and get them up to speed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, one of the animators came up and he said, a lot of the animators, they know about your work, and we would like we want to go to Ron and have you take over the picture from Art Stevens. And I said, whoa, wait a minute. I said, Art, I said, I spent several years working with Art in the same room with him. We're good friends. And I said, there's no way I'm going to take over his job.
Was Art actually producing the show, or?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, so he was the producer initially.
He was in charge, and Art and I were very close friends. Mm-hmm. So anyway, finally, Ed Hansen had heard from Ron Miller that they wanted me to, I don't know if some animators had gone to Ron or what. Anyway, Ron called me up to his office with Ed Hansen, and asked me if I would like to take over as producer on The Black Cauldron. And I said, well, no, not really. I said, I'm happy in story. And I said, I don't want to get involved in all the hassle that's going
politics.
On. The politics.
Yeah, I don't blame you.
I said, I really don't want to do it. And so then a week or so went by, and then I got called up again and given the same pitch. And finally he said, look, you got to, he said, somebody's going to take over the picture. You're not replaced. Art Stevens is going to be replaced. So either, you take it or somebody else is going to take it. So I thought, well, geez, if they want me, I didn't have much choice. I just felt.
Yeah.
So that's how I got involved with it.
And did Art Stevens retire at that point?
Yeah, he did right after that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And so now as a producer, were you still doing story development and were you doing any artwork early on during the development phase?
No, I was just doing story.
Okay. Yeah.
And, I was writing it down.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It wasn't storyboards at that point.
No, I wasn't boarding.
Yeah. You were coming up with the script, so to speak.
I did the first one I did was the, Taran climbing up and going into the castle where he's captured.
You wrote that sequence?
Yeah.
You worked on that?
Yeah, I wrote that sequence.
That's fantastic. And then it started to pick up steam at that point. Do you know what year that? Do you know what year it was when they made you the producer?
It was 1980, I think.
1980. Yeah. So it's still a couple more years of development before things really got. They were the most of the department was still finishing off Fox and the Hound. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And talk a little bit about once the production team started coming on to the project, because you were instrumental in bringing Andreas Deja in.
Yes. I had, we didn't really settle on any of the characters yet.
Design.
And so Ed Hansen came up with a portfolio and showed me, he said, this is Andreas Deja, a young German boy. And I looked at his work and it was like he had that Disney DNA. His style was the Disney style. It was really weird. So I said, gee, hire this kid, And he said, well, he's in Germany. And I said, well, bring him over. So anyway, that's how Andreas got involved.
And Phil Niblink was already there because he came in from Cal Arts.
Yeah.
And Glenn Keane didn't really work on the picture much, did he?
I don't know.
I think Glenn may have skipped over Black Cauldron.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah, yeah, because he was instrumental, certainly, in Fox and the Hound.
Yes.
Yeah. But Phil Niblink and Andreas were the two supervising animators.
Yeah.
Yeah. And talk some more about what it was like getting that picture together, because there was a lot of issues.
Well, yeah, it was the whole thing was just kind of a mess. There was one group wanted to go one way and another group wanted to go another way. And we had bits and pieces. My job was, I can remember the frustration of it, is just trying to get some sort of, I knew we had to get the picture out that it was costing a lot of money. And if I didn't, I had to get it going because the animators were coming off Fox and the Hound and I didn't want to see anybody laid off. So it was trying to get this kind of thing organized. And that part of it is kind of a nightmare to me.
Yeah, and the story too was difficult because you're dealing with this series of fantasy books. There was like five books in the series.
Yeah, that's the first thing I did was read the books.
Yeah,
and then trying to But being the producer of that picture was not a very pleasant experience.
Well, and I think it's important for the audience to realize that in the middle of production on The Black Cauldron, the studio itself, the whole Walt Disney Company, was in the process of a potential takeover.
Yes.
And there was a financier from Wall Street who thought the company was worth more in pieces sold off. And so that caused chaos in the board. Roy Disney had resigned from the board and then engineered the White Knights, the Hunt brothers from Texas, to come in to take a stake in the company to help save the company. And all this is swirling around while this group of artists is trying to make a movie.
Yeah, and we had lost a lot of our top animators, you know, and
it really was. I mean, it was a studio in transition at that point.
Yeah,
yeah. And then partway into the production, you had all these new executives coming in that most of them had worked over at Paramount. You had Michael Eisner and Jeffrey Katzenberg. Frank Wells had been an executive at Warner Brothers. And all these people come in and they didn't know their animation from their elbow.
That's right. Yeah. So the whole thing was just, I don't know. I don't know how I survived it, but I managed to somehow.
Well, you know, it was trial by fire because it was my first picture. I came in 1984 at the very bottom of the Black Cauldron. I was an in-betweener in the effects department. So I remember what was going on at the studio at that time. And what were your thoughts when you were hearing some of this stuff?
Well, I was busy. I was trying to concentrate on picking up the pieces of the story and making a picture, you know, I just wanted to get a picture made. And so it was, I don't remember. I know there was every day was a hassle, seemed like.
Yeah. I couldn't imagine being around during that time with all that stuff going on. And you, Mr. Hale, dealing with the politics involved with, you know, the new management coming in, One Direction going one way, you going the other way, and you being producer having to reel in all of these cats in order to get this film made. I couldn't imagine just the amount of work you had to pour into it just to get through the finish line.
And then also, after Don Bluth had left with the bunch of animators, they didn't want to make that get any more frustration going with the animators. So they sort of said, "You guys are, this is your studio. You're going to be in charge. So you know, do whatever you feel good doing." And they wanted to do, I'd go down in the A-wing and to see one of the animators, and you'd see somebody standing on his head and somebody seeing how long he could stand on his head. And so they were just, the production was going nowhere. I kept getting the budget slip every week and be another $100,000, and nothing was being done. And I was trying to, gather wet cats or herding
cats.
Herding cats. Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so the production obviously did get going and it did get done. But then you had Jeffrey Katzenberg come in on top of the studio side of the business. And he had his own viewpoint on the story. And can you talk a little bit about that and some of the funny things that happened along the way, because he didn't understand animation at that point?
Yeah, he came in and Katzenberg was, there was a book, I don't know if you ever heard of it, it's called What Makes Sammy Run? It was a book.
Yeah,
Bud Schulberg.
Okay.
It's about a young man in Hollywood and how he maneuvered around and managed to take credit for things he didn't do and didn't take blame for anything that went wrong. And that was kind of Katzenberg. In fact, a funny story is going back to Iwo Jima. I had that book. That's where I read it. It was on that ship going to Iwo, and I read What Makes Sammy Run, and then I gave the book to somebody else, and he loaned it to a guy named Sam Baranja from Vermont. And we were on the beach, and the bullets are flying all over the place and zipping by, and Sam crawls up to the guy that loaned him the book and says, "Hey, here, I want to return your book." And everybody thought that was hilarious in the middle of this.
He wanted to return it.
The bloodiest battle of this world.
Yeah, he wanted to return it just in case, huh?
He said, yeah.
No time like the present.
I want to give you your book back.
Interesting. You know, that's interesting.
Yeah. So anyway, Katzenberg, he didn't really understand animation. But he wanted, Roy came back at the same time, and Roy wanted a job there. He sort of engineered getting Katzenberg and Eisner back, and he wanted a job there. And he talked to me about it, and he said, "You know, Joe," he said, I want to get involved in the studio again." And he said, "I'd like to get a job here." He says, "You know, I come in every day, but I don't get a paycheck, and I don't have a job." And
he said, "Assignment."
And he said, "You know, Katzenberg doesn't want competition or something." Anyway, they didn't care much for each other, I don't think. So he said, "I'd like to work with you and help me get, you know, back in the studio." So that was, I thought that was great.
Yeah, so I was going to say, he eventually became, he was vice chairman of the company, but he was chairman of the animation department. He really saved the animation department.
Exactly. Anyway, so we set up a screening for Eisner and Katzenberg and what's the guy that was killed?
Frank Wells.
Frank Wells.
Yeah.
So we ran the picture.
We the got work reels, right?
The work, yeah. And it was at night. It was at 7 o'clock, I think, we started running. And about a third of the way through, Frank Wells wasn't there. So anyway, they started it anyway. So he comes in with a big, huge bag of popcorn. And they're talking, the movie's going, and they're talking and eating popcorn. And I thought, oh, God, I wanted to stop and start over. And they, no, let's just keep it running. And anyway, Katzenberg said the next day, he said, "Cut 10 minutes out of the picture." And I said, "Well, what 10 minutes? You know, you want to look at it again and show me what don't you like about it?" He said, "Just cut 10 minutes out of it." So I got with Roy, and Roy would, we tried to figure out where we could cut. So we'd meet every morning and run it on the Moviola, and Roy liked to have a few drinks at night. And being with our heads together on the Moviola, and after he had had a night of drinking, that was a job in itself. But anyway, so we cut, I think it was two and a half minutes, and we thought, well, that's not hurting it too much. So we called, set up a meeting with Jeff, and he comes into the sweat box, and he said, "We're getting ready to run it." And he said, "Did you cut 10 minutes out of it?" And I said, Roy, I think, said, "No, we just cut about two and a half. He said, "I said 10, and he left. And here's what he was doing, according to Roy. He said, "He's wants to let me know he's my boss." And I said, "Well, yeah." And he said, "Well, you know, he has a contract, and I don't even have a paycheck." So we got our heads together, and we cut a few more minutes out of it. And then Jeff Katzenberg brought in a bunch of young guys. I don't know where they came from. And he cut 12 and a half minutes, I believe. And it was never the same picture again. It was, yeah. It's too bad.
But you know what? It's still I think, held up very well. Roger Ebert gave it a good review when it first.
Oh, yeah. It got some. It got some. Yeah.
Yeah. And I rewatched it last week because I hadn't seen it in a while. And I thought it played very well, you know, things considered, with everything that went on to get that movie made, I thought it played very well.
Yeah. And there was it cost, I think it was.
They said $25 million.
Yeah, that's what they told everybody, but it was probably a lot more than that.
Well, then I heard later they said it cost $70 million. Yeah. But then I had a good friend in Keith Cheney in the he ran the projection department. He told me later, he said, we were told to unload all of our charges onto the Black Cauldron because they're going to write it off as a loss. So all the departments, studio overhead that had budgets that they were trying to make look better, charged it all to the Black Cauldron because they were going to write it off anyway. So yeah, that's people that say it cost $70 million. Well, that was, you know, creative bookkeeping, really.
Yes, sir. Yeah, that wasn't the real cost of the movie.
No.
And certainly with the new management that came in, Jeffrey and Michael and those guys, they looked at the Black Cauldron as, this isn't our movie, we don't care about it. And they didn't want to put any more into it than was already spent.
Yeah, I remember talking to Card Walker about that, and I said, you know, it was a better movie before they got their hands on it. And he said, well, you know, do you ever think about the fact that they might not have wanted it to be successful in the first place?
Because of they didn't want Ron Miller to have, after they had booted him out, they didn't want him to have a successful last release.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think that the real victim during that period was this movie, because it got no marketing support or anything when it was released. And I think the funny story, too, was that Jeffrey asked you for the outtakes on the movie, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, that's it. You want to look at there? We don't have outtakes.
Well, yeah, I mean, if for the audience, when you have a live action movie, you're usually shooting with multiple cameras. You have different angles on a scene, so you have a lot of footage to pull from to do editing work. With animation, you don't have that. You're animating scenes that have been laid out in a sequence. And there's no extra, so to speak. There's not another angle or whatnot. And Jeffrey was asking for the outtakes so that he could go into editing and see if he could recut the picture. Yeah.
That is amazing to me. That is absolutely an amazing comment. But here's one thing I want to know, sir. And maybe, Dave, you can chime in. But I've always wanted to find out that you talked, Joe, about the editing, the taking out of the 10 minutes. Do you know where that footage is? I think there's tons of Disney fans that are like myself who watch The Black Cauldron, love the movie. As Dave says, it still holds up. Where is the footage? And do you think if they find it, would we ever be able to see the footage that was?
It wasn't totally animated, was it?
Well, some of that footage I think was still in... somewhere it was in story sketch, some was rough animation, some was cleaned up animation, some was dailies, color dailies.
Yeah, some was already in color, yeah.
Gosh,
yeah.
I would love to see that.
Well, you know, the funny thing
somewhere in the vaults there, all that footage is laying somewhere, but...
But, you know, the funny thing is that over the years, I've had people reach out to me and say, you know, where's the missing 12 and a half minutes? Well, and I don't think people realize it wasn't just a 12 and a half minute chunk. It was bits and pieces from throughout the whole film to kind of tighten it up and get it down to a certain running time.
Well, that's another question that's for you guys, because was Katzenberg just really just hell bent on keeping the runtime super short? Because the movie runs 120. No, I'm sorry, like 80 minutes, something like that.
80 minutes. Mm-hmm.
So was he just really hell bent on keeping it tight like that, or was there absolutely no wiggle room whatsoever? He said in his mind, animation needs to be this amount.
I think partly they wanted to make it less scary for little kids, because when we had audience reaction screenings at different points of the picture, and there would always, you know, they would invite people from all around Burbank to come in and bring their kids to see a Disney movie on the lot. And I was always there. And there was always several mothers taking their screaming kids up the aisle and out of the theater.
Well, you talk about that, yeah.
They wanted to make it less scary. They wanted to make it for, more of a kid's picture.
Right. And the original intent was to actually age up the animation a little bit and scare the teenagers, right?
Yeah. Well, that was the whole idea behind the, when we made the film, that I had heard was that they wanted to make a film that would appeal to teenagers, because teenagers wouldn't be caught dead in a Disney picture at that time. We were making these silly, you know.
Yeah. And the G rating was also the kiss of death for the movie exhibitors theaters, right? Because if they had a G rated movie, they'd fill a couple of matinees, but they wouldn't bring people into
the evening.
Yeah. So
movies were Hollywood was going through a change. Tastes had changed.
And Black Cauldron was the first PG animated Disney film to be released, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Amazing. That's amazing. Well, speaking of a little bit scary, you know, the Horned King is a great villainous figure. He's super dark, and I personally enjoy him. But what was it like, maybe if you could remember, doing that type of character design with a I guess at that point, relatively young, Tim Burton. You guys remember working with Tim Burton at all in that film? What your thoughts were?
Tim, I didn't know. Someone said Tim Burton has really got a unique design ability.
Style.
Yeah.
He said, you should look at his stuff. So I said, well, okay, bring him up. And I put him in a room with somebody else. I don't remember who it was. And he started designing characters for the Cauldron. But they were great pictures, but they were so different from Disney that, like I said to him, I said, well, you know, I love your work, but... you should have been here on day one, and I'd give you a hand to do the picture. You could have done it whatever way you wanted. But, you know, this is not the Disney style, and those characters won't work in the story that we're working on. So, appreciate his work.
He did have influence on the Horned King design, though, yes?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He had influence. Yes, he did.
That's very cool.
And Joe, I'm just curious, what do you remember? I mean, do you have a fond memory from the Black Cauldron production at all? A particular incident? You don't have any fond memories, huh?
No. He enjoyed his work. He enjoyed his work in story, and he was great at. He was a great story person. Very, very, very creative, and he really wanted to stay in story and contribute to the story. And I think maybe the storyline would have been better if he had remained in story instead of having to go in management, which he did not want to do at all. And then when Katzenberg came in, then it was like two heads bashing against each other, and Joe would not sit back and take any crap off Jeffrey. Therefore, Jeffrey hated Joe, and the feeling was probably mutual. But, you know, Jeffrey wanted everybody to recognize him as the head, and he knew everything and do it my way or get out of the way. And Joe and he just locked horns, and that was it.
Well, we were in a meeting one day, and he was talking about how he cut 3.5 minutes out of Spielberg's first the space movies.
Close Encounters?
Yeah. And what was the one with...
I don't know what you're talking about.
I can't think of it. I'll think of it anyway. It sort of indicated that, where's the one where...
Steven Spielberg movie?
Yeah.
Was it E.T.?
Was that Al John?
Was that E.T. before he left Paramount?
E.T.?
No, it was after...
not Schindler's List, no.
Well,
anyway.
Yeah.
Anyway, and I sort of called him on it, said, you mean you think those pictures, these were real successful? You know, like with Star Wars and...
That was Lucas.
Lucas, yeah, that's the one. I meant Lucas.
Oh. You meant Lucas.
Yeah, anyway.
And go ahead, finish this. You called Katzenberg on this 3.5 minute cut. What happened?
Yeah, well, he got upset because...
You challenged him.
I challenged him, yeah.
Yeah, I think he. It sounds to me like he just wanted to let everyone know that he was the boss.
Yeah,
that was always the case throughout Jeffrey's career, is that he was always constantly in search of the accolades.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that goes back to your story, Joe, about the what makes that book you were talking about.
What makes Sammy run?
That's right. It goes back to that book once again. You know, I get it. I don't know, Dave, we're at that point where we have some questions from our audience.
Before we do that, we do have a couple questions from our listeners that they've sent in. But Joe, I did want to touch on the music because the great Elmer Bernstein did the score for The Black Cauldron. Can you talk a little bit about that and where it was recorded and what it was like working with Elmer Bernstein?
Oh, yeah, he was, very professional. He came in and we had... the assistant directors had taken bits and pieces of different scores from different movies, and we had a score behind it when as we were making it.
Sure.
And he didn't want to see it with that score, and I said, "Well, just it'll kind of give you a feeling, because some of the music you'll find is music you've written for other pictures." And he said, "Oh, okay, go ahead." And he ran it, and but anyway. Yeah, he liked it very much, and he brought this girl over from England. If you remember in the score, there's this strange sound.
For the bobble, right?
Yeah.
And
she had some kind of a...
Oh, the theremin.
Yes.
Yeah. A theremin, yes. She did the theremin sounds.
I love that.
Yeah, he was... He did a really good job. And one of the things that bothered me when Katzenberg was cutting the damn thing was he was cutting some of his music that I liked out of it also, and which didn't help.
Was it decided early on, Joe, that this film wasn't going to be a musical, the musical adaptation? Because...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just always assumed that, we'd have a...
How about the special effects? I understand, Dave, because you were so involved in the effects, just like Joe was for many years over there at Disney. The visual effects, was it the first time Disney utilized that electronic animation, computerized animation, and was it decided early on to use that experimental type of animation in this film?
No, in fact, the computer animation kind of came along after the picture was started, and the only computer animation we really used was for the boat when they were escaping from it.
The boat and also the princess's bauble that followed her around. I remember we did that on an HP desktop. And then in the effects department, we had to tape the printouts onto animation paper.
That's amazing.
Yeah. It was rather antiquated, but it worked. Yeah. It worked.
I have to say, go ahead, Joe.
Speaking of Elmer, let me show you something real quick here.
Okay.
Joe is now picking up his iPad and he's moving it to show us something on his wall. And we're getting over to it. Here we are. It is.
Can you see it?
No, you got to lower it, I think. We're seeing only part of a photograph. But now I'm seeing two frames. The edges are two frames. Right. I think you got to raise it up. Oh, there. Joe with his bolo on, his Mickey Mouse bolo.
And Elmer.
And move it over just a little bit further to the, there you go. Now we see it. Yep.
Nice.
It's Joe and Elma Bernstein. What a wonderful thing.
I love that.
Joe's got the baton in his hand. Elmer's got a big smile. Where was the recording done, Joe? Was that done in Los Angeles or London?
No, it was done at, it was Universal.
At one of the Universal stages? Yeah. And I think at this point, why don't we go to a couple listener questions, Al John?
All right.
You've got them.
Let's do it.
Skull Rock Podcast answers your email.
All right, Joe. So we've got this question from Just Telling Guess. I think that's how I pronounce it. I'm sorry if I butcher your name. But he goes, who brought the Pride and Chronicles onto the radar at Disney Animation? And what aspect of the final film in the Black Cauldron are you most proud of?
So when were the books acquired at the studio? Do you know?
From what I understand, is Don Duckwall, his wife, worked in the volunteer work in the library. And she discovered the books and brought them home. And Don Duckwall, who was
he was a production manager, wasn't he?
And he brought them in and showed them to Wooly. And Wooly called Frank and Nolly up in Milton. And that's how they got started at the studio.
And they bought the rights.
Okay. And the second part of that question, Al John, was...
what part, Joe, are you most proud of from For the Black Cauldron?
Well, I don't know. I liked it all, actually.
I think you're proud of getting the movie done.
Right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's an accomplishment. Yes.
Honestly, it took a Marine, a combat-hardened Marine, to get this movie done because of all of the stuff swirling around that had nothing to do with the movie that was going on at the time.
Yeah, I mean, you have no idea.
that's real project management.
I only had a little bit of an idea. I was so low on the totem pole at that time, but I could see it going on.
the bubbling cauldron. Yes.
Well, Joe, I want to thank you so much for being part of the show and coming on as our guest and having your lovely wife, Beverly, there. You guys have been married for now, I want to say, almost 70 years.
No?
60? 60 years? How long?
We got married in 1965.
Oh, in 65. Okay. I thought you guys were married in the early 50s.
No.
How old do I look? No, I was
no.
A kid.
Oh. You look fantastic. But the lovely Beverly, you raised two sons. You had a more than 40 year career at Disney.
His 40 year career, yeah.
Yeah, and you've been married over 50 years. Wow. Yeah. I mean, holy mackerel.
Yeah.
You know, Joe, before I let you go, and Dave, I'm sorry, I've got to ask this one more question because Spencer is pinging me on Facebook. Spencer Wright would like to know, Joe, regarding an animated Disney film, can you please explain what the role of layout artist is and what your role was in The Black Cauldron, or how your role as a layout artist was different than Evan Earle's role in animation?
Evan Earle? That was Sleeping Beauty.
Yeah, that's right. Sleeping Beauty. He was referencing Sleeping Beauty there.
Oh, well, anyway, what a layout artist does is you work, one of the reasons I really enjoyed layout was you work with the director and you have a lot to do with staging and you have a lot to do with the story. And you take you work with the director and you draw the background. And you draw the characters in the background. And for instance, if you're doing a long room and a character comes through a door and walks across the stage and picks something up and goes out another door, you draw the layout. It's all done in pencil. You have the drawing of the door open and closed and open and the character walking through and picking up something, and you design whatever the character picks up. And in other words, you draw the picture and the animator takes that layout and your drawings of the characters and they animate the characters. And then it's shot as a screen test in test camera in black and white. And you have the whole picture, the whole scene animated in pencil with the...
And then you draw the back.
Yeah, and in some sense, you're a cinematographer when you're in the layout department.
That's it. That's it.
It really equates.
You're our director, cinematographer.
Tell them.
Yeah, and you're helping with the staging by placing poses of the character along on the layout.
That's right.
Lighting director and blocking.
And the thing that's interesting is that when the picture is done, and they show the scenes from the picture, nobody knows what a layout man does. All the credit goes to the background artist.
The layout man draws backgrounds, and then Ivan Earle painted backgrounds that Joe had drawn.
In Sleeping Beauty, they would trace that onto a illustration board, and then Ivan painted them.
Gotcha.
But whenever you see a picture from Sleeping Beauty, it will always say Ivan Earle.
But it was based on one of your layouts.
We're the unsung heroes of animation. Nobody knows what a layout man does, and nobody really cares. It's when the picture's on the screen is what they're impressed with.
Well, and that's always the way. And one thing that I think is certainly worth mentioning is that, and Al John, you mentioned it briefly, lighting. The layout artist is also figuring out what the lighting is going to be, and oftentimes do tonal sketches. Joe is showing us a story sketch.
Love it.
Or it's a color story sketch from Black Cauldron.
That's amazing.
It's wonderful.
Yes, sir.
That's fantastic, Joe.
Oh,
absolutely fantastic.
Wonderful.
Anyway, Joe, thank you so much for being on. Beverly, thank you for being there as well. It was really wonderful to talk to you about your entire career at Disney, your World War II service to this country. You were part of the greatest generation that ever mobilized to win the World War.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right, Joe. Hey, Joe, Beverly, it was great seeing you. I look forward to talking to you again in the future. Thank you so much for being on the Skull Rock Podcast.
Thank you, guys.
How do we send me the information so I can access the podcast?
We will. We'll send you a link, and I will do that tomorrow via email, Beverly.
Hold on a minute.
Okay.
Just one more thing.
One more thing. Always one more
thing. This is a caricature.
All right.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's a character. Now, who's
Dolly is now Jolie.
Ah, so Joe is showing us a caricature of him as a fair folk.
That's awesome.
One of the sequences that was heavily trimmed and almost cut out completely from the film. All righty, Joe. Thank you. Thank you, Beverly. Have a wonderful rest of your weekend, and we'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Anytime.
And that was a great interview. What a lovely man.
Yeah, you know, Nancy and I went out to see Joe and Beverly a couple of years ago, and I did a couple hour recorded interview with him that I have stashed away for future use in some writing. But whatever that is, I don't know. But I've got, you know, we've gone out and visited him. And then yesterday I had him on a panel discussion. We had Phil Nibling, the animator who did the Gwaithank dragon animation. And we had another guy named Les Perkins, who did some ancillary bonus material for the subsequent like DVD and VHS releases of the film. And we did a panel discussion via Zoom for the Hyperion Historical Alliance, which is a, I don't know if you, the HHA, if you've heard of it. It's a group of Disney historians that I belong to. It's about 100 and something of us. So we did something for that yesterday. So it was really nice. And, you know, he, I mean, 95, the guy, four. You know, he fought on Iwo Jima.
I know, right?
And I didn't even know when he talked about it. I didn't even know that he was. It went to Nagasaki after they dropped the bomb.
Now I had no idea. I had no idea he did that. Now I did know that he was an Iwo Jima vet with the 13th Marines and the 5th Division. But you know, I had no idea. But man, what a great guy!
Yeah,
and Beverly. And his wife Beverly was also great too. He had a little bit.
Yeah,
of that.
She's a sweetheart. She really is terrific. You know,
that's so awesome. We do have some upcoming guests coming up. Did you want to do a little tease to our listeners?
Yeah, you know something. What's really neat is we've got coming up in November. We're going to have George Scribner, who is the director of Prince and the Pauper, the Mickey Mouse featurette. That's celebrating its 30th anniversary. This month. And also film composer Bruce Broughton is going to be joining us later in the month as well. We're just starting to bring on all kinds of cool guests, and I'm having fun, and I'm loving the fact that we're getting email questions and questions through social media from our listeners. So keep that up. We look forward to seeing you right here again next week on the Skull Rock Podcast.
I'm Kristen Hetzel, co-host of Dining at Disney Podcast. Every week I chat about dining at Disneyland and Walt Disney World Resort and Disney Cruise Line with my fellow foodie, Bubba. We also feature restaurants and food reviews, information to help you plan your dining, Disney food news, recipes, and a monthly panel discussion. Visit diningatdisney.com and subscribe to Dining at Disney Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcast, iHeartRadio, or your favorite podcast platform. Dining at Disney Podcast, the happiest plate on earth.